Is Huawei really a security risk? The LeBron James of Fortnite streamers might change the way the industry pays influencers. Amazon employees get to play Tetris at work. And what happens when teens have relationships only online? All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 84, recorded Thursday, May 23rd, 2019.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Peak PTT, the leading provider of push-to-talk systems for business communications. For instant, always-on, nationwide communications, visit peakptt.com and use promo code TWIT for 15% off.
And by FreshBooks, the number one accounting software in the cloud for self-employed professionals and their teams. You can try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/TNW.
And by the IntraZone podcast from Microsoft, your bi-weekly conversation and interview podcast about SharePoint, OneDrive, and related tech within Microsoft 365. Get highlights on usage, adoption, and how SharePoint works for you. Subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher today. Hello! Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where each week we talk to people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. I'm imagining everybody has Huawei on the brain.
Huawei on the brain.
Huawei on the brain. We've all been obsessed with Huawei this week. Turns out there's been a lot of news around Huawei. Huawei is one of the most successful phone makers in the world. In dramatic form, all of that looks like it could change almost overnight. Last week, an executive order declared that U.S. companies were no longer allowed to do business with companies who pose a national security risk. On that list, Huawei, which has set off a chain reaction that was wide-reaching consequences all around, not just for the company itself, but quite possibly for the stability of the economy, worldwide even. Joining us to walk through some of these scenarios is Vlad Savov from The Verge. Welcome to the show, Vlad.
Hello, guys, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you on here. So, first of all, maybe taking a step back a little bit, what kind of concrete evidence is there that Huawei phones are a security risk, or is this not at all about Huawei phones specifically?
The latter part of your question is the correct one. It's not really about the phones. The way that the US ban functions is it addresses Huawei as an entire entity. And the US has more of a concern with Huawei's 5G equipment, networking infrastructure. And there's some suggestion that Huawei might be working with the Chinese government. There might be some behind-the-scenes spying going on. U.S. spy agencies have warned about Huawei. But in terms of concrete evidence, I haven't seen much, and I've been looking for it. And again, for our purposes, it's worthwhile to segment 5G and networking infrastructure from the phones. It's just kind of a blunt instrument that the U.S. government is using, and it's bundling the phones in with the networking equipment.
So the executive order where it was issued, and of course, you know, companies, American companies, Google, a number of American companies have adhered to that. They've kind of gone back on that as well, because, you know, as I was alluding to, the story has changed a little bit. Talk a little bit about the companies specifically, how they've cut ties with Huawei and what that actually means to, as far as direct effects on Huawei's business and how it does business.
Well, Huawei is one of these companies that is actually quite self-sufficient in a lot of ways. Unlike other Android smartphone manufacturers, it produces its own chips and it does its own design and engineering and so on. Also modems, again, going into like 4G and 5G, it competes with Qualcomm. But Qualcomm is one of the partners that Huawei has been working with, and it is now discontinuing its business with Huawei. Intel is another one, providing Huawei chips for things like Windows laptops. Microsoft has kept quiet about this, but it seems like Huawei is going to have a problem being able to ship any Windows laptops with Windows on them. And of course, Google is the biggest one. Google is the provider of Android. It discontinued its license to Huawei for Android. And what that means is that Huawei can still make Android phones, but only use the really, really bare bones Android open source project version, which for the purposes of somebody in the European or North American market isn't really Android. It's probably not going to be recognizable as Android, because when you think of that operating system, you're thinking Gmail, YouTube, Google Maps is a huge thing, Chrome, all of those additional things that Google bundles, and of course, the Google Play Store. That's really the key. That's the reason why Android can compete against iOS, because both of them have the third-party ecosystem of apps. So without the Play Store, I don't see how anybody can have any hope of selling an Android smartphone, and that is really the challenge for Huawei on its consumer business side.
It's a huge, huge challenge. What about the ARM news that I think we saw this yesterday, that ARM put out a memo to tell its staff to stop any work with Huawei? How can that affect the company?
Okay, so my poetic way of putting this is that Android was a sledgehammer where Huawei's business just gets completely discombobulated, and then ARM is the final dagger. Because without the ARM license, Huawei just can't operate. It doesn't have a mobile business, because even though it produces its own processors with the Kirin series, those are based on ARM's designs and instruction sets. So without being licensed by ARM, the only viable way that Huawei can keep making these processors is to just completely disregard intellectual property. It's just to play into all of the stereotypes of Chinese companies saying, okay, we don't care, we'll copy you freely. And Huawei has never been one of those companies. That cliche is not really the case. And Huawei itself is worth crediting the company. Its founder and all of its executives, in as far as they've made comments, have said they appreciate that their partners, including ARM, Google, and so on, they're limited by legal liabilities within their own countries and they have to abide by them. And they've said thank you to their partners for working with them for so long. So Huawei has been quite classy about this whole situation, whereas the US seems to be really determined to obliterate it from the planet.
Mm-hmm. So what do consumers do? Like, you know, you said this isn't an issue with the phones. I have a Huawei Media Pad that I was going to review. It runs Android. Will it still continue to run? Will it just not get security updates? What about the people that have this hardware in their hands? What do they do?
Okay, so as Jason said, it's still quite a fluid situation. What Google and Huawei have both promised is that security updates will be delivered for Android devices already out there. They do say that devices that are already sold and devices that are already shipped to stores are not going to be necessarily affected by this. But the big issue is Android OS version updates coming down the line. So if you're buying a smartphone today, you're kind of hoping, not guaranteed, that you get a couple of years worth of Android OS updates. With this situation being what it is, you get none of that. You get updates for your apps. You still have Play Store access, but you won't get the future Android OS updates. Now, the big caveat to this is that this whole situation could be resolved if the US and China resolve their trade dispute. Like, this is something that can be removed altogether. I mean, it's an executive action, so it can just be removed overnight.
So if it is removed, if they resolve the trade dispute, I mean, does that necessarily make the cell towers more secure? I mean, does that necessarily mean that China's not spying on us through those networks?
Absolutely not. It doesn't. But at the same time, we have no evidence that that's occurring. So this is, as far as I'm concerned, you know, as a tech journalist, this is really exciting because it lets us get into the whole economics and international relations thing. And we have an excuse to write about that. But at the same time, the thing that bothers me is that there is not enough transparency going on. So we're hearing a lot of suspicions. We're hearing a lot of national security reasons why you can't talk about it. But I haven't heard of a single incident where Huawei itself can be said, okay, this is the law and this is how you broke it. And the other thing, there is no path for Huawei to come back into the United States good books. I haven't heard the United States say, if you make these amends, we'll let you back in.
Mm. Yeah, that's a big one right there. Now, Huawei has been preparing for something like this for quite a while. We've been hearing for years that they've been working on their own OS. And I'm sure, you know, especially in the last year, knowing that the intensity around, you know, kind of the U.S. accusations of security invasion, you know, and working with the Chinese government and everything, that's been intensifying. So, of course, they've been working through this internally to prepare in some ways. Do you think they're ready? Were they prepared? Were they underestimating kind of this the strength and response of what the U.S. could do?
Well, like most parts of the story, there's multiple threads to this. So one is that Huawei has been stockpiling chips, so it can no longer do business with Intel, Qualcomm, Broadcom, and Xilinx, I think was the name of the other company. But it's been stockpiling chips for 3 months. So it has leeway for 3 months worth of time to figure out some new plans on the hardware side of things. And as I say, it's been quite self-sufficient, making its own processors. It isn't as reliant on Qualcomm as a company like, let's say, OnePlus, which basically ceases operations if Qualcomm isn't going to cooperate with it. But on the software side of things, Huawei says that it's been developing its own alternatives to Android and Windows for many years now. The issue is that, well, at least I have no faith in Huawei being able to achieve anything worthwhile on those fronts because, as I say, it's the Play Store situation. And with Windows, again, you have a massive library of applications and programs, which Huawei just isn't going to recreate overnight. And as a consumer, you go into a store and me personally, if I'm buying a laptop or a computer, I'm asking, can it support Photoshop and Lightroom and a full suite of Adobe apps? Those are the ones that I use a lot. If it's a smartphone, does it have WhatsApp, Instagram, YouTube, and all of those applications? And it's not going to. I mean, if you look at the history of smartphone operating systems, the past 6 or 7 years are littered with the corpses of them, and all of them have struggled by the fact that they do not have an app store.
Yeah, no question about that. So if in, you know, on the opposite side of the spectrum, Huawei's business is then limited to China, let's say, you know, extremely, you know, take out all the other locations where they might have a presence, and they have a very strong presence there now. If they were then limited to China in order to run their business, do you think they could survive given where they're at right now and what they require?
I would have said yes until the ARM situation. So the way that we can kind of perceive this is up until even last week, Huawei was basically ruled out of entering the U.S. market because U.S. spy agencies, well, security agencies, excuse me, have warned against it. So AT&T and Verizon just do not do business with Huawei. It has no access to the U.S. market. Then when Google yanked its own version of Android, you could say Huawei has lost the European market. But without the ARM license, Huawei can't really even make processors for its smartphones within China.
Yeah, wow. And then on the opposite side of that, kind of stepping outside of Huawei, what about the U.S. economy? Because, you know, there are a lot of U.S. companies that also rely on business with Huawei, a collaborative relationship with Huawei in order to run their business as well. So this isn't just affecting Huawei. I mean, arguably, it's affecting them much, you know, much more severely, let's say. But how do you think this could affect the U.S. economy as a result of all this?
Well, there's no doubt that there will be an impact. The immediate one is to Google and to Android. Huawei, up until this situation, was well on the path to being the world's biggest smartphone manufacturer. It was on the path to surpassing Samsung by the end of 2019. That doesn't seem likely to happen because even if things get restored, the reputation here is going to be so massive that I don't see its sales rising as they did previously. And it's worth saying, this year, Huawei with the P30 Pro introduced a night mode in its camera, which is the best that I have seen on any smartphone camera. Tech journalists like myself have spent a couple of months praising it to the high heavens and just pointing out how much stronger and better that is than anything that Apple can do with the iPhone. And again, going back to Google and Android, this sells Android devices. Huawei has undeniably been good for Android device sales. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. Another is Huawei hires a whole ton of American consultancy companies. It's these companies that are not in the public eye, but do generate a lot of revenue because consultancy services are expensive. And Huawei spends a lot of money on them and on research of the U.S. market and the European market and so on. And all of that money that comes out of Huawei is just being blocked effectively by this ban.
Now, is it incumbent upon the U.S. government at all to prove that there is a security threat? Like, is that something that you see happening, or can they just continue this with saying, well, we think it is, and that's enough?
It's not incumbent on them. The U.S. is powerful enough to do whatever the U.S. pleases. But what it does is it undermines its reputation with other international partners, whether you're talking about European countries, the EU in general, or Japan. It shows that the U.S. is acting arbitrarily, right? The rule of law, which the U.K. came up with and then the U.S. adopted and embraced, demands that you have a level of transparency. And in terms of international trade, if you want to be thought of as a reliable trade partner, you have to show good reason. You know, because, I mean, we're talking about Huawei in China right now, but if the United States did the same thing to, let's say, Toshiba in Japan, wouldn't we be asking for reasons and transparency there?
Yeah, absolutely. Vlad, your coverage on this has been awesome and thorough, and really appreciate your time, Vlad Tsvov, with The Verge. Thanks for carving out a few minutes for us today to talk about this. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you, guys. This is a really exciting story.
Right on. All right, take care, and we'll be following your work going forward. Thanks again.
Uh-oh. Do Fortnite streamers need a union? After the break, we'll talk to Taylor Lorenz from The Atlantic about influencer workers' rights. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Peak PTT, the leading provider of push-to-talk systems for business communications. I accidentally pushed to talk, so that was the sound you just
heard.
Who
are you talking to? Who are you pushing?
I was pushing. These are the devices. They look like little phones. They're super easy to attach to your belt or stick in your pocket or your purse or wherever. You know, company cell phones that we normally use, they're expensive. But they're also a huge time waster. There is no Fortnite, no Snake, no Solitaire or any of the other, no Instagram, all the ways we waste time. They do not exist on here. So you can boost productivity and cut down costs today with Peak PTT. Peak provides advanced IP-based push-to-talk systems for small, medium, and enterprise businesses. You can leverage the internet, cellular data, and Wi-Fi networks to transmit voice over the internet. It provides instant talk, location monitoring, and emergency alert notifications. Local, nationwide, and worldwide coverage. They're rugged. These devices are made to withstand dirt, water, and also extreme temperatures. There's no contract. Billing is month to month. You could try it and see. Less than 1 second connection time. Connect with hundreds of users at once or talk privately with anyone in your group. There's a central tracking and communication center from any computer. They have real-time GPS tracking for accurate and complete visibility. The K2 PTT system is ideal for small and medium-sized businesses. This system includes an affordable walkie-talkie-style handset. It's PTT 84G. They have iOS and Android apps and PC dispatch software for device location tracking. The Everest PTT system, that's what I have right here, the Everest. That is capable of handling deployments of any size. This includes the PTT 584G rugged handset, 5 nines of network availability, lower latency rates than some of the most significant players in the industry, PC-based dispatch consoles to locate devices on demand, and then view them on a map. Push-to-talk calls last an average of 15 seconds versus the 50 seconds for traditional calls. Get in touch faster and operate more efficiently with Peak PTT. Visit peakptt.com and use the promo code TWIT at checkout for 15% off. That's peakptt.com and use promo code TWIT for 15% off. And we thank Peak PTT for their support. Now, just in the past few months, we've seen tech employees begin to start collectively organizing around workers' rights. Everyone from Google AI engineers to Uber drivers are pointing out that all this disruption of the economy isn't necessarily great for them. Joining us to talk about her story on the plight of esports streamers and other internet influencers is Taylor Lorenz from The Atlantic. Welcome back to the show, Taylor.
Hey, guys.
So your story revolves around 21-year-old Turner Tenney. He's a Fortnite streamer who's bringing a lawsuit that might change the way the industry operates. Who is Tenney suing and why?
Yeah, so Tenney, who goes by Tfue on the internet, is essentially the best Fortnite player in the world right now. He's really top of his game, really made a name for himself over the past year. He's blowing up. And he's part of this gaming collective called FaZe Clan. And they're kind of this like loose esports team. They have also like YouTubers, other types of streamers affiliated. But so he joined this gaming crew about a little over a year ago in April. He signed the contract when he was just 20, and it was before he really blew up. And now, you know, he's become sort of like best in class, and he's still subject to this really kind of predatory contract that, you know, can take up to 80% of his, you know, brand deal revenue in certain cases. So he's trying to essentially get out of it.
So you've written before, we've talked to you before about, you know, influencers that are just basically teenagers doing their own thing, having a popular Instagram, and then people will come and say, yeah, I want, you know, to sponsor you. And that's some of the same stuff going on there where they're being taken advantage of. Is this pretty similar to that, or is there something different going on here?
I mean, so first of all, I would say, like, I mean, 90% of brands are not necessarily exploiting influencers. It's not to their benefit either to exploit influencers. Influencers get exploited via brand deals through lots of different means. Like, a lot of times it's somebody impersonating a brand that might be kind of scamming the influencer, trying to get access to their, you know, login credentials to steal their Instagram account. Yeah, like maybe they're not getting the best deal because it's the influencer themselves negotiating, because they might be not have management. They might not be big enough. This is something totally different. I mean, this is like really, Tfue's not just an influencer. He's a gamer and he's a top gamer. And I think that, like, you know, with that whole, that's a whole sort of like adjacent industry that comes with a lot of other stuff, like prize money, for instance. You know, like the Fortnite World Cup is, I think, like the prize is like $13 million or something. So, you know, there's just a lot of other stuff that goes along with being a successful gamer. It's not just like YouTube videos.
I'm below Florida. $13 million. I'm like, wow, I chose the wrong job.
I mean, there's a lot of money and no real oversight. I mean, esports is emerging, and I think, like, with this lawsuit too, people are trying to figure out exactly how to classify esports players. Some are kind of repped by old, like, music exec type people. Some are repped by actual, you know, former athlete managers. It's all over the place. So I think, like, what, you know, Tfue's trying to do with his lawsuit is kind of like set a precedent and try to put some structure and stuff around that.
So in the lawsuit that Tfue or Turner, depending on if you know him personally, is waging here, like, are the numbers that he's got in his lawsuit differing from the numbers that FaZe issued? Because they issued a statement, I think, on Twitter, if I read correctly, and they broke out some numbers. Like, how do they compare? Were they saying, hey, this is actually very fair, or?
Yeah, they've issued like 100 statements on Twitter, many of them contradicting each other. Like, the founder was like out fighting with Tfue's brother last night, actually. The Blast, which is an amazing gossip site that constantly breaks YouTuber news, actually got a hold of the contract, which they posted this morning. And it actually does back up a lot of Tfue's claims. Mm. So, you know, I saw other people saying, well, this is just one version of the contract. We don't know that this was the final, or, you know, but even if he just signed this version as an initial version, it's still a very predatory contract. So, you know, I think, like, the reason this all blew up is that they've been trying to kind of like negotiate this in private for 6 months, and it's really gone nowhere. And, you know, Tfue wants out, and he also just thinks that people, you know, he's being taken advantage of. Like, he shouldn't be subject to this like exploitative contract that he signed when he was 20, when he didn't understand the stakes.
Absolutely.
So do you think they should be represented by the same people athletes are represented by, or, I mean, should there be like a Screen Actors Guild of YouTube, or, like you said, music producers? I mean, what's the right way to go here?
Yeah, I mean, so what? One thing that Turner's claiming in his lawsuit is basically saying that FaZe Clan is violating the Talent Agency Act, but basically a California law that stipulates like how it's regulation around how talent agencies can work. And so his argument is that like FaZe Clan is essentially acting as a talent agency for all intents and purposes, but not subject to the same regulation because the talent that they're working with is for the most part esports players. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's like one of those things that remains to be seen how all of these different people are, you know, classified. I think there's also just so much misunderstanding. Like, people don't understand the difference between a top Fortnite esports superstar and like a 15-year-old vlogger. Like, you'll see them equated in the same article. And so I think it's kind of like, you know, people need to understand all the different nuances and all the different sort of classifications there are. You know, it's not just, oh, everyone creating content for the internet now is under this union or something. You know, they all, every sort of role is very different and comes with different, you know, deal structures and stuff like that. So
Content Creators Guild or something along those lines, maybe. Are players pretty united or universally wanting regulation? Are there any reasons why they might not want this to be regulated?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually most people are hesitant for any regulators to step in, mostly because they have no clue about the industry, like less than, you know, it's the same with a lot of like tech regulation. You know, it's just these sort of older lawmakers that, you know, representatives that don't actually understand anything about how the industry works. And so regulating it is a challenge, and you can end up with very problematic legislation that ends up hurting these creators. So, you know, I think people are split. I think that what we'll see, you know, aside, before we see any kind of like blanket regulation, I think what we'll see is lawsuits like this one that set certain precedents, you know, that then people have to sort of like abide by, and, you know, the rules will sort of form organically, which is, by the way, what happened with traditional Hollywood too, and child actors and things like that. It was all sort of set through, it sort of progressively grew and grew and grew until finally there was regulation around it. But it, you know, there was lots of lawsuits and messy stuff first. Mm-hmm.
So one of the reasons I want to talk to you is I've been fascinated by just the rise of worker organization in the tech industry, but it's really different, like in terms of skilled labor and unskilled labor, and that, you know, that's been historically different. So like when airline pilots strike, it can be very successful because there aren't that many airline pilots, or when, you know, an engineer strikes or demands something, it's successful. But then maybe an Uber driver, like if all you really need is a driver's license, it's not as successful. But what I'm hearing you say is that this particular person is very skilled in what he does. He's not just like you said, a guy in, you know, a middle schooler in his bedroom streaming his Fortnite. So there's a small group of very skilled streamers or esports athletes that would fall under this sort of regulation?
I don't know about the regulation. It would probably, you know, if they set a precedent, like esports players are classified in such and such way, and therefore, you know, these agencies that recruit them are subject to the Talent Agency Act, like that would impact streamers of you know, lots of different sizes. In terms of like a strike or collective action, I haven't seen any gamers try to engage in stuff like that. Well, there's the gamers union. I mean, there people, that's not true. They have tried to like collectively negotiate, but it's, in this case, it's actually Turner kind of wanting to be his own independent person. I think like this guy is like the LeBron James of Fortnite. And, you know, so he doesn't want to be like in some deal where he, you know, has to worry about all of these other kind of like parties involved. He's a top talent. So yeah, it's kind of different and messy. I don't see like all gamers going on strike. That wouldn't really be to their benefit, but it is to their benefit to kind of like, you know, just make sure that, you know, the interests of the talent, you know, are being represented. And a lot of that just comes down to also having a good manager or like negotiating well. And, you know, sometimes that's hard when you're, you know, new to the industry. It's the same thing that happens in Hollywood.
Absolutely. What kind of barriers could something like this create for new up and comers? Because, I mean, definitely a lot of like the creator space, the influencer space, like there's this view that like becoming a star in Hollywood is off limits, but I could very easily become an influencer or a famous game streamer, and there would be less barriers for whatever reason to do that. Could something like this create more barriers?
No. Okay. First of all, it's not easy to become like.
No, I know it's not. I know it's not. I think the view is, yeah.
Yeah, like I just want to make that clear, because I think a lot of people think like, oh, they're just easily replaced, and it's, yeah. I mean, it's very different with YouTuber, vlogger, you know, full-time vloggers, and somebody like Turner, who's an elite esports athlete. You know, this is like a level of skill that it's very hard to get. And, you know, he's a very compelling person. So, I don't know if it would create new barriers. I think it would probably just add some structure around the deals, which could be a good thing. I mean, right now everybody is out, you know, there's no transparency in the industry really, because everyone's doing contracts behind closed doors. You know, you don't really know what even the person next to you is making. So, you know, I think that opening a discussion about this and what's fair for, you know, young players to be like, what's a fair split for them to sign in terms of brand deals, you know, how much winning should they be entitled to, things like that, it's a good conversation starter.
Absolutely.
So I just looked this up because I was curious. I am one of those people that don't really understand. I mean, I understand that he's the LeBron James. I get that metaphor. And there's not just someone coming behind him. But are there college esports teams? I mean, it says there's 20 colleges with varsity esports programs. Do you know anything about college esports?
I mean, I just know that it's like that it exists. There, I mean, there's tons of esports teams, like tons. It's the same way that with any sport, it's like you can come up through smaller leagues, through smaller teams, through playing in smaller tournaments and get, you know, bigger and bigger and, you know, go onto more sort of high profile, you know, teams and groups. But I don't really know about the college esports scene, to be honest. Like, I know that, you know, a lot of places offer, you know, that option, but I don't really know.
Well, because, I mean, they're not, they didn't do a great job with, like, college non-esports, you know.
Regular sports.
Yeah, the payment system there is totally off.
Yeah, it's true.
Totally off. I would say, like, in that sense, esports players have an upper hand in the sense that, like, a lot of them are very internet savvy and really don't need college if they're going to be, like, if they're peak of their game at 21, like, you know, they don't, it's not like the NBA where you have to play for a college team in order to play for, like, a pro team, I'm pretty sure. So it's kind of like, I think that they can like bypass some of that. It's not like you have to go through a college team at all. Yeah. Really. I mean, Turner just blew up in the past year from playing online and getting really good and, you know, making a name for himself. So there's not that like traditional structure where they have to go through these systems.
Taylor Lorenz is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Please follow her on Instagram at Instagram/TaylorLorenz. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Taylor.
So much. Thank you.
Take care.
We'll talk to you soon. All right. Up next, it's kind of like Tetris, but with Amazon boxes. I think we've all kind of played this game before. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by FreshBooks, the number one accounting software that makes billing painless. From starting a project to accepting payment, you're going to spend less time on your paperwork and more time doing the work that you love when you use FreshBooks. FreshBooks lets you create professional-looking invoices in seconds. It does not take long at all. You automatically record expenses with ease, track your time quickly and efficiently so you can focus on the things that matter most to you, serving the needs of your clients. So you don't, you know, former accounting experience isn't required. FreshBooks has very powerful features to make everything easy for you. You can create and send invoices, accept credit card payments, no more chasing clients for checks. You can log every expense with a simple snap of your camera on the phone. Stay on budget for every project by tracking what you've spent, track your productivity. It has easy to understand and view reports, multi-currency billing, automatic tax calculations. That's going to save you some headache. And a whole lot more. As a hardworking small business owner, you're constantly evolving to keep up with your customer and industry demands. And FreshBooks is there to ensure that you have all the information and tools that you need to really understand and to grow your business. FreshBooks has mobile apps that revolutionize the software accounting world. So you can imagine being able to communicate with clients, get paid, organize your expenses, all from the palm of your hand. You just make it super easy. FreshBooks is used and trusted by small business owners in over 120 countries, and you should check it out for yourself. Why haven't you joined the over 24 million people who've used FreshBooks? You can do that now. Visit freshbooks.com/TNW. Make sure and enter Tech News Weekly in the How Did You Hear About Us section, and you'll receive 30 days free. That's freshbooks.com/TNW. Make sure and enter Tech News Weekly to receive your 30 days free. And we thank FreshBooks for their support. So sometimes when I'm packing our car, like I will be doing this weekend to get ready to go camping, I kind of feel like I'm playing a real world version of Tetris, fitting the boxes and the containers in the trunk just right, you know, ultimately trying to maximize all of that space. Now we've got a larger vehicle, so this is less of an issue, but nonetheless, the point remains. Amazon apparently does this too, but they do it for billions of dollars. The Washington Post wrote about an experiment that Amazon is gamifying the warehouse fulfillment process for its workers. Much in the past has been written about the tedium of Amazon fulfillment and the drive to ship more and faster and kind of push people to their maximum point of efficiency. So Amazon is hoping that by implementing game mechanics into the system, workers will, yes, be happier. They'll also be more efficient. Basically the way this works is that a robot brings the merchandise to the worker. The worker identifies the item and places it into the bin where it goes. All of that is scanned once completed, and then their progress is plotted and compared to other teams or even entire floors, so that they're constantly competing with each other to stay motivated, with games like Mission Racer, Pixin Space, Dragon Duel, and Castle Crafter. Don't you wish you worked at Amazon, Megan?
So it's like esports.
Yes, it is. Yeah. They need a union.
I am glad to not work at Amazon. They are not apparently the best place to work, as I've heard. This, I mean, it's interesting. If, you know, if people grew up playing video games and that makes them more productive, it's great. I mean, I'm a little bit suspicious of the way it sort of hides. Apparently, according to this article, it hides what, you know, it hides some of the aspects, so you don't really know what you're supposed to be, how you're supposed to be comparing. Yeah, to other people.
What your level is.
Yeah. Right. So I did a little research there to see how much Amazon was hiring, like in the area for warehouses. So they were hiring in Brisbane, San Francisco.
Brisbane, I think. Yeah.
I think, yeah, not Brisbane, like Australia. Yeah. Brisbane, South San Francisco, and in San Francisco for warehouse workers. And
you're
the salaries.
About getting a job there, aren't you?
I was thinking about it. $16 an hour, like $16.47 or something an hour.
Okay.
Which you cannot. I don't think you can really live in San Francisco on $16 an hour. It would be very difficult. So yeah, I mean, it says that. I don't know what the minimum is. That the minimum wage in California? I'm not sure. I should have looked that part up, but it.
California,
I don't know.
Minimum wage eleven U.S. dollars per hour. That is,
yeah,
that is bad.
But I mean, a company like Amazon, it feels like with the warehouse workers being the heart of the operation, that, you know, getting paid so little. But I mean, it makes that is.
The bleeding heart of the operation.
Yeah, yeah.
In some cases. I mean, but I will say, like, if they're, like, I understand why Amazon would do this. Amazon's not the only company to do this. Uber, you know, mm-hmm. It kind of has some gamification qualities where, you know, they offer rewards based on number of rides. And I don't know if that compares against other drivers in the fleet or whatever. But, and I'm sure I've worked at, like, I've definitely worked at companies, like, years and years and years ago. I used to work for Sears in their collections department. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you how much fun that job was. but they definitely had, you know, you had departmental goals and stuff. And right. It was, you know, it was all tracked on a board. Mm-hmm. And the top, you know, collectors, you know, got called out in first and second mm-hmm. place, and they got rewards as a result of it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the same thing. It's just like the technological version of that. And when you have something, when you're working a job that can be kind of drudgery, you know, that can be so monotonous and repetitive, whether they're being paid well or not, that's another story. Like, mm-hmm. Amazon should be paying those workers well. But if you're okay with it as an employee and that makes your job suck a little less, mm-hmm. then I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm. and the truth is that I think Amazon warehouses are more closely watched than a lot of other warehouses. I mean, if you read about, like, the other people that are trying to keep up with Amazon, you know, just like the companies that do shipping for, like, Macy's or, you know, competitors of Amazon, like, it's a much scarier place to work in terms of, you know, just never stop, never get a break, everything's measured. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it's worth it to think about our demand for, you know, everything right now, what that does to the people, making sure we get it.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of blows me away that yesterday, like, afternoon, I ordered two things on Amazon and they're going to be delivered to me this morning. And then to think about, like, just the demand that is placed on the fulfillment center, like, we really don't, I know that I don't, when I order, usually think about kind of the mechanics behind the scenes of how that is all operating. And if they're promising such a quick turnaround time, like, that ends up being a lot of pressure on the worker. Mm-hmm. Hopefully Amazon is doing an okay job of supporting their employees. And, like, you know, like we've said, we keep hearing these stories where it sounds like they are not in some cases. So, but as far as this game is concerned, the results apparently are not monitored specifically. So workers aren't, like, penalized because they did poorly in the game. It's meant to be more of, like, a distraction or an aid to help them focus on something that might make them a little bit more, you know, happy, I guess.
So they don't get bored.
So they don't get bored or worse.
I wonder if they're allowed to listen to podcasts while they're doing it.
Oh, man, I'd hope so. You could get a lot of serious podcast listening and audiobook listening. You'd probably get pretty smart just listening to stuff all day at Amazon.
Up next, we explore what it means for teens to have relationships with people they've never met in real life. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by The IntraZone, a podcast from Microsoft. The IntraZone is your bi-weekly conversation and interview podcast about SharePoint, OneDrive, and related tech within Microsoft 365. You can get the most out of SharePoint and learn how it works for you. Every episode covers important topics and information about Microsoft SharePoint, including a news and announcement section, a focus topic of the week, guest perspectives from various experts, users, partners, and customers, a partner highlight where they'll feature a partner from the Microsoft ecosystem. There's also a frequently asked questions roundtable. They will list upcoming events, conferences, and workshops. So much information. If you use SharePoint, then you should listen. You'll learn how to more easily share and manage content and empower teamwork throughout your organization with the technology that you already have. And be sure to catch this week's special episode live from SharePoint's conference in Las Vegas. You'll hear from Jeff Tepper, Microsoft's VP for Office 365, OneDrive, and SharePoint. Announcements about what's rolling out in 2019, a live panel discussion on the evolution of SharePoint in organization use, and a whole lot more. Be sure to check out their latest episode at aka.ms/theintrazone and subscribe to The IntraZone wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe to The IntraZone today. That's IntraZone. It should come as no surprise to any teen or a parent of a teen that kids are living their lives online, and that includes romance. Writing in the Wall Street Journal this week, columnist Christopher Mims points out that because teens, as well as 20-somethings, experience early puberty and later marriage, they've had to adjust to what that means in terms of their intimate relationships. There are no longitudinal studies on how these online-only or online-first relationships work out in the long run, but just like the relationships that started the old-fashioned way, they seem to have their advantages and their challenges. Now, I have seen this in my own home. Just not even just romantic relationships. The idea of, oh, I know this person or I know this person.
You know, oh, yeah, like,
you
right.
You know them, but how do you know them? From Instagram. You know, just, so that kind of IRL or in real life, like I don't even, it's getting so blurred, I think.
And in those examples, are they people that like they don't go to school with?
Yeah, they're people like, that live in the town that are friends of friends, you know, but they know them from Instagram.
I see.
Or Snapchat.
I mean, they're spending so much of their life. I mean, their lives, we all are spending so much of our lives online, but they're growing up with that being kind of the way that it is. I'm not surprised at all that more and more of these friendships and even further, you know, as relates to this article, that those relationships are fostering in that way. What blows me away is to have an entire relationship beginning to end that occurs online to actually have a relationship with someone maybe that doesn't live in your location, your geographic location, that exists only online, and to go through the arc of that that is, you know, absent of any sort of physical connection, and then come out the other end and be like, yeah, like that relationship's over.
Right.
That just kind of blows me away. I mean, but it makes sense. It makes sense to me.
Well, I think it's different for like 20-something versus teenagers, especially early teenagers.
Sure,
like my experience, my own experience of middle school, my experience of watching my children in middle school, it's like everybody's friends and then suddenly someone's dating and that means you stop talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you remember? It's like, oh, we're dating. Now we're too shy to ever talk to each other at all. So like maybe they're talking online, but so I think that like makes sense because it, you know, they're not talking to each other in real life anyway because it's terrifying when you're 13.
Yep.
But the later is interesting too, but I think you can cross off a lot of things without having to go through the, you know, the,
sure,
the that issue of actually meeting them. But then in this story, there's, you know, the person that suddenly discovers this person she was dating was also dating many other people at the same time, which,
yeah,
you know, is easier to do if you don't ever see the person.
Absolutely.
In real life. Also, a psychologist that he interviewed points out just the fact that we need physical touch, like for our own health, like our immune system and our health. And, you know, now that everybody has like, you know, FaceTime or Skype on their computers and their laptops and they're in their room, it's like it's pretty close to real life, except for the touch part.
So. Right. Yeah. This really just reminded me of back in like the mid 90s. I met a girl online in, I guess it would be IRC chat.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a solid 3 months where we never exchanged photographs, and it was just purely like getting to know each other. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I ended up flying out to Montreal to meet her face to face. And we actually ended up dating for a couple of years. You know, I ended up living in Montreal for a little bit. She is the reason that I ended up in the Bay Area. So we moved to San Francisco because she had dual citizenship. But so I can, from a personal perspective, I can completely understand this, right? Like if you just spend a lot of your time online, you find somebody, you connect some way, and it might not even be real, but it feels pretty darn real, and it feels like a relationship. Who knows the reality of that though? And just the intensity of technology use and living. You know, teenagers living their lives in their phones. Mm-hmm. Like I imagine it's just, this makes a lot of sense, mm-hmm. probably a lot more sense to them than it does to grownups. But yeah.
You had told me that story about the meeting, the uh-huh. woman in Montreal. And I was like, oh, should I bring that up? Remind him? Or maybe, I thought maybe you didn't want to talk about it, but I think that's
nothing
really
not to talk about there.
But I think innocent. That's really different though, you know, without, cause you didn't see each other's face. You didn't. And I think that's important too, right? Like, why are we so judgmental of what each other looks like? Isn't it great to know what's, you know, in your mind first?
So. Sure. Catfishing at that time was not even a term that existed.
Right.
But you know, that was the, I had plenty of people. Mind you, this is like early internet. So the fact that I even did this scared a lot of my friends. They were like, don't fly out there. She's going to murder you. You're going to die. You're going to be like on the news or something. And I felt in my heart that that was not the case. And thankfully, I'm still alive. So it all worked out. We're actually still really great friends. It was an interesting experience. And definitely not uncommon, especially now.
Yeah. And there was something about meeting someone on the internet so early, like you already had that in common, you know, just like, sure. Oh, you're on this.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Like you're on this chat room. I'm on this chat room. I mean, right. that is what those story points out, like somebody who meets on a Minecraft server, you know, and then just suddenly ends up in the same Discord. And it's like, that's what grandpa, you know, some grandma's going to be like, yeah, I met your grandpa in the Minecraft server.
Oh, yeah, Minecraft. You remember when we were building that day? Oh. Took a picture of it on my cell phone. Yeah. What is a phone? Anyways.
Is it like the thing that's embedded into my forehead?
you mean you didn't call everyone by blinking your eyes two times? All right, that's it. That's all we have for you, except we have one more request. We have a survey for you. It actually focuses on something different than Minecraft. It focuses on how you use collaborative software at work. It's brief. It takes about 6 minutes. It does not collect any personal data. If you want to help us out, you can go to twit.to/survey14. That's survey and the number 14. The number's 14. And we appreciate it if you do. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us, tnw@twit.tv.
Subscribe to our show at twit.tv/tnw, wherever fine podcasts are sold for $0, totally free. You know what else is free? Following us on social media. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. Follow the network. You get to see what's going on behind the scenes. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to Burke, John, and John, and Colleen, because she was in here for a moment. And thanks to you. All you have to do is walk in the room, and I'm going to thank you. Thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.